I want to talk a little bit about our nation's founding. And you may recall there was a court case. I'm going to weave in some talk about the courts here, too. And I should have gotten my act together and given Russ some quotes to put up on the screen. But I'm going to read you some of these quotes, so bear with me. You know, a few years ago, there was a bit of a to-do about the words "under God" in our Pledge of Allegiance. And some people were litigating in California, and they were saying, well, those words were just added by Congress in 1954. Those words haven't been there from the founding of our country. That doesn't really have that much meaning. Well, what the attorneys for the United States argued, or rather the attorneys defending the law and the presence of "under God" in the pledge, argued, they said, no, this is a statement of fact. This nation was founded under God. See, the prayers who are attacking it said, oh, it's like a prayer. It doesn't sound like a prayer, but it's a prayer, so you have to take it out of our Pledge of Allegiance. And what they missed was that this is a statement of historical fact. Our nation was founded under God. And I want to talk about that a little bit, because our founding fathers, from the very beginning, on July 4th, 1776, by the way, it was actually July 2nd that the Continental Congress signed the Declaration of Independence, but it wasn't promulgated, it wasn't published until July 4th. So, you know, technically, if you want to celebrate July 2nd, you can do that too. But anyway, what they were breaking away, they were breaking away because they believed that the King of England and the Parliament had violated the higher law, the law of God. And that's the thing. If you read the Declaration of Independence, which, again, is what the 4th of July is all about, it's about the signing of the Declaration of Independence. It's not about the firecrackers, right? The 4th of July starts on that document. And that document, what do you remember? Can anyone quote any words out of the Declaration of Independence? I know one phrase everybody knows. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's the one that you hear about in school. That's the one that's what America's all about. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? Well, that's what we all learn. But the Declaration of Independence, if you read the whole thing, which our schools don't, the public schools don't teach anymore, the whole thing is about God's law. And it's about, we are making a petition to God. We are making a petition. We're declaring something in front of the world, all the nations of the world, that we believe we have a right because of what God has given us to do what we're about to do. There are actually four references to God in the Declaration of Independence. And, of course, the schools aren't teaching us those four references. The first one is in the first sentence. You might remember this part. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve political bonds that have connected them with another and to assume the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them. In other words, we are entitled by the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God to this status as an independent country. The second sentence, that's where the founders mention our rights. They mention that these rights come from God. Quote, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The third reference to God is in the closing of the Declaration of Independence. You see, the framers recognized that the only judge whose opinion mattered in all of this, the only judge that would determine the fate of the United States was God, not some international body, not some treaty, not the King of England, but God. And so they didn't need to reconcile any misdeeds that the United States did with other countries. They only needed to reconcile those misdeeds with God. And so they wrote, we, the representatives of the United States of America, appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions. And then finally, in the last clause, they recognize that the nation's fate was in God's hands. Quote, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. End quote. Isn't it funny how the 4th of July, which started with that document, has become all about fireworks and all about, you know, Americana, which is wonderful, but we forget that the founding document, the original document, was really a petition that was laced throughout with references to God and an explanation that we believe we had a right because of God's law and because of the role of God in our national affairs to become an independent country. And isn't it sad that school children in public schools are not being taught those aspects of the Declaration of Independence? Now, lest you have any doubt about the importance of Christianity to our nation's beginning, you know, sometimes there are a lot of revisionist historians, which is a, you know, funny way of saying wrong historians, who come back and say, oh, no, Christianity wasn't that important in America. That's just a modern myth. Hardly. And it wasn't just the Declaration of Independence, which was penned by Thomas Jefferson. Let me give you a few quotes from the founding fathers themselves. Remember Patrick Henry? He's the one who said, "Give me liberty or give me death," right? Those are his immortal words. Those are the words that the public schools will teach. But he was also a member of the Continental Congress. He was the 5-time governor of the state of Virginia, which, by the way, was the big state. The two power states were Virginia and New York. You know, he was an extraordinary leader of his time. And the fact Patrick Henry did not go to the Constitutional Convention had many people thinking that the Constitution wasn't going to make it, because if you don't have Patrick Henry behind you, it's going to be real tough to get the people of the United States behind you. Anyway, this is what Patrick Henry said. Quote, "It cannot be emphasized too strongly or too often that this great nation was founded not by religionists, but by Christians. Not on religions, but on the gospel of Jesus Christ. For this very reason, people of other faiths have been afforded asylum, prosperity, and freedom of worship here." End quote. Okay, that's Patrick Henry. Well, how about George Washington? George Washington was a walking, talking legend. I mean, George Washington truly was a sort of giant walking on earth in his own time. He was kind of a cross between, Michael Jordan and Abraham Lincoln. I mean, the guy was a truly amazing figure. And so if anyone spoke for the American people, George Washington did. Well, he was a deeply religious man who prayed continuously and constantly publicly for his nation. And that's particularly true during the winter of 1777 and into 1778 at Valley Forge, which of course is when 1,000 men of the Continental Army moved into Valley Forge, which is about 25 miles west of Philadelphia. 11,000 men marched in. And by March of 1778, 2,500 men had died of either freezing to death or disease. 11,000 go in, 2,500 are dead within 3 months. That's roughly 20 deaths a day on average. Extraordinary. He was not only worried about his men dying in the freezing cold, he was also worried about men deserting. And so he was on his knees in prayer constantly during that period in Valley Forge. And that's, of course, what led to some of the famous paintings you may have seen of George Washington in prayer during that period. And he later requested, after making it through that trial, he later requested that Congress declare a national day of prayer, in part for getting through Valley Forge and in part to get on with the struggles ahead, so that the nation might beg the Lord's forgiveness and pray for victory. And Congress did so by declaring that national day of prayer on March 20th, 1779, and it was for the first Thursday in May. Later, he would become president, of course. In his inaugural address of 1789, Washington wrote this. He said, quote, "The propitious smiles of heaven can never be expected on a nation that disregards the eternal rules of order and right which heaven itself has ordained." A few years later, in 1792, he would write this, and this one really means a lot to me. He said, "I am sure that never was a people who had more reason to acknowledge a divine interposition in their affairs than those people of the United States. And I should be pained to believe they have forgotten that agency which so often manifested during our revolution, or that they failed to consider the omnipotence of that God who is alone able to protect them." End quote. He would be pained to believe if his country ever came to a point where we forgot the role of God in our nation's founding. James Madison, father of the Constitution, was equally religious. He said this in 1778, "We have staked the whole future of American civilization not on the power of government, far from it. We have staked the future of all our political institutions on the capacity of mankind for self-government, upon the capacity of each and all of us to govern ourselves, to control ourselves, to sustain ourselves according to the Ten Commandments of God." That's James Madison, who later drafted the words of the First Amendment. The words of the First Amendment are now being used to drive the Ten Commandments of God out of our schools, out of our public places. The author of the First Amendment. Okay, how about some more presidents? John Adams, the second president, said in 1798 about the Constitution, quote, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." John Jay, first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and also one of the writers of the Federalist Papers. He said that it is the duty of Americans to elect Christian leaders. Here's what John Jay had to say. Quote, "Providence has given to our people the choice of their rulers, and it is the duty as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers. End quote. Imagine if anyone in Congress said that today. We are a Christian nation, and voters should prefer Christians for their rulers. He would be drubbed out of town by the press especially. In 1782, Congress got in on the act. Congress passed the following resolution. Quote, the Congress of the United States recommends and approves the Holy Bible for use in all schools. End quote. The direct consequences of the belief and the faith of our founding fathers led to the prosperity, the survival of our country. And, you know, the founding fathers were well aware of what Scripture says about this, about nations that place themselves under the guidance of God and under the guidance, and in the New Testament, under the guidance of Christ. But let me remind you of a few of these. The 33rd Psalm, starting at verse 12, says this, blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people he chose for his inheritance. From heaven the Lord looks down and sees all mankind. From his dwelling place he watches all who live on earth, he who forms the hearts of all, who considers everything they do. But the eyes of the Lord are on those who fear him, on those whose hope is in his unfailing love, to deliver them from death and keep them alive in famine. Look at the second psalm, starting at verse 10. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you be destroyed in your way, for his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. Our forefathers were certainly familiar with Isaiah 33:22. For the Lord is our judge. The Lord is our lawgiver. The Lord is our king. He will save us. Now, not only did the grace of God assist this country into coming into being, indeed make it possible for this country to come into being, God has preserved us in our moments of national crisis. But that's something else that people forget today, too. I talked a minute ago about the Declaration of Independence. Well, let me tell you about another set of words that you've sung probably more times than you can count, our national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner. Now, the only words of the Star-Spangled Banner that you ever hear are the first verse, which, of course, is what we sing at the baseball games, right? Well, there were four verses to the Star-Spangled Banner, and even the first verse has religious significance if you know what they were singing about. Let me tell you a little story about this. The Star-Spangled Banner is, of course, written by Francis Scott Key, who was a deeply religious, deeply prayerful Christian, and he wrote it about a miraculous event that he witnessed, and he wrote about it to give glory to God. It happened during the War of 1812. Which, by the way, America nearly lost. In 1814, the city of Washington was burned and raided by British troops. We lost the Battle of Washington. But Madison had to flee to Brookville, Maryland, to get out of town to avoid the British troops and avoid being captured. British troops then, over the course of the next week, moved north, or northwest, I guess, up the Chesapeake Bay. Their next target was the city of Baltimore, which was the third largest city in America. And it was undoubtedly our most important port along the mid-Atlantic seaboard. If the British took Baltimore, it would be all over. September 10th, 1814, just after Washington had been burned, an attorney from Washington named Francis Scott Key sailed out with a small crew to negotiate, sailed out on a negotiation flag, and they sailed out to negotiate with Alexander Cochrane, the admiral of the British fleet. Why were they negotiating? They wanted to secure the release of Dr. William Beanes, who had been captured during the raid of Washington. He was a prominent doctor and was a personal friend of Francis Scott Key. So the British admiral received Key and his colleagues, and after several hours of persuasion by Key, the admiral relented and said, okay, fine, you can have Dr. Beanes, we'll free him. But the admiral said, we're going to have to detain you guys for a few days because we are about to begin our bombardment of Fort McHenry and of Baltimore, and we can't have you telling the American troops what's about to happen. And so you're going to have to be our prisoner for a few days on this ship, and then we'll let you go. And furthermore, Alexander Cochrane said, you know, and really this negotiation doesn't matter anyway, because this is all going to be academic in a few days. Baltimore's going to fall, the war's going to be over, and we're going to negotiate, you know, truce terms, and the prisoners will all be released at that point anyway. But he said, at any rate, you're going to have to be our guest on this prison ship for a few days. Well, the reason Admiral Cochrane was so confident was that this was going to be an assault by land and sea. There were 19 British ships in the Chesapeake Bay, and they were going to hit Fort McHenry, which guarded Baltimore. In addition, there was a ground force of 5,000 British troops that were going to be hitting the city of Baltimore by land. and they believed that there was no way they could possibly lose this battle. The shelling began on the morning of September 13th, and it went all day long and then all through the night of September 13th into the morning of the 14th. Now, the mortars on the British ships had a range of 4,000 yards. The old cannons in Fort McHenry only had a range of 2,000 yards. Kind of like boxing with someone whose arm span is twice your arm span. You're not going to get any blows, and that's exactly what happened. The British ships stayed out of range of the American cannon and just pummeled the fort over and over again. It looked inevitable that the fort would fall. How do you fight back under circumstances like that? Flying over the fort was a famous flag, which is now in the Smithsonian, a very large American flag, 32 feet by 40 feet, which even though Key and his companions were several miles away watching this, they could see it because the flag was so huge. And all the American defenders of the fort needed to do to stop this relentless shelling was just lower the flag and surrender. So if the flag stayed up, that meant they were still fighting. If the flag went down, they were surrendering. Well, throughout the night, after a full day of shelling, Key and his colleagues continued to watch from the prison ship. And bear in mind, this is several miles away. And they were praying aloud, constantly, not sleeping, praying for the safety of their nation and for the victory of their nation in this battle that seemed impossible. And so they watched all night long, but you're thinking, wait, they're looking at a flag 2 miles away, 3 miles away. How are they going to be able to see that in the night? Well, through the rocket's red glare. When the bombs would explode on or near the fort, they would be able to see the flag. The rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Through the prayers of the people on that ship, and undoubtedly the prayers of the people in the fort. Well, at dawn on the 14th, Key saw that the flag was still flying. Somehow, miraculously, the fort had withstood the bombardment. Well, what kind of bombardment? 25 straight hours of shelling. Between a total of between 1,500 and 1,800 mortar shells fell on or near the fort, many of them weighing over 200 pounds, by the way. These weren't primitive cannonballs. Equally amazing was what happened in the land battle. Now, Maryland had to muster the militia. There was no standing army to defend Baltimore. And so there were 3,000 militiamen, and what that means is Maryland farmers who showed up with their muskets, who showed up to meet a professionally trained force of 5,000 British soldiers on the road to Baltimore. And these militiamen had their training every few months. They'd get together and try to train, but they were nothing like these professional soldiers. And this was not like some kind of a Revolutionary War battle where they could, you know, surprise them in the woods or something like that. This was fighting in the open. This is what the British was the best army in the world at doing. And so the militiamen tried their best. They formed three lines. The first line gave way, and the British marched on through. The second line gave way, but the third line held, and the British land forces were turned back. And that was nothing short of a miracle. That was not supposed to happen. With fewer men, inferior arms, without training, they turned the British back. And so Key wrote this famous poem, which was later set to the tune of actually an old British drinking song. And the tune was originally called The Defense of Fort McHenry, and it later acquired the more popular name of Star Spangled Banner. But let me read to you the fourth and final verse of the Star Spangled Banner. Blessed with victory and peace, may the heaven-rescued land praise the power that hath made and preserved us the nation. Then conquer we must when our cause it is just, and this be our motto, in God is our trust. Amen. Praise the power that had made and preserved us a nation. That's what the Star Spangled Banner is all about, prayerfully fighting an impossible battle and somehow coming out alive. President John Quincy Adams was the sixth president. He was the son of John Adams, the second president. He lived through all this history. He was a young man graduating from college right when the Revolutionary War began. He became president in the 1820s. And while he was president, he was also a chairman of the American Bible Society, which he said was as important a duty, if not a more important duty, than being president. And on July 4th, 1821, he said this in his message to the people of America. He said, quote, "The highest glory of the American Revolution was this. It connected in one dissoluble bond the principles of civil government with the principles of Christianity." End quote. That was our president speaking. 42 years later, in the middle of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln relied on prayer to get him through the war and to lead him in his decisions. He regarded the Civil War in part to be the consequences of the nation's sins. And in 1863, in his proclamation of a national fast, he said this to the nation, quote, "It behooves us then to humble ourselves before the offended power, to confess our national sins, and to pray for clemency and forgiveness," end quote. The conclusion is inescapable. Our early founders and our nation's leaders in the early republic, they didn't lead this country by marching on horseback. They led this country on their knees in prayer. And God help us if our leaders today fail to realize that we must lead on our knees, not marching on horseback. Well, now I want to talk about where we've come today. How do we get so far from the founding generation, which was so deeply a Christian nation, to where we are today with what I call radical secularists who are trying to drive God from the public square, to drive Christianity out of public life, and certainly not to have anyone say that this is a Christian nation. Oh, no, we can't possibly say that. Well, much of it has happened in our courts, unfortunately, and that's where I have a bit of an interest as a law professor. And it's been in the courts through action by organizations like the radical secularists of ACLU and some of their fellow travelers, persuading unelected judges to change the way our country is governed. One of the battles has been with regard to prayer in public schools and prayer in public generally, or Christian statements in public. Let me just give you a line of what's happened, and it's just a relentless line of decisions. 1962, Engel versus Vitale. The court eliminates prayer in public school. Supreme Court, that is. 1963, the Supreme Court rules that Bible reading in public schools, without any comment, just reading the verses of the Bible, that's unconstitutional. Now, remember, that was Congress in 1782, which said it recommends that every school in the country read the Bible. That was the generation that wrote the Constitution. But, of course, our Supreme Court knew better in 1963. 1980, the Supreme Court ruled that the posting of the Ten Commandments in public school, without any religious commentary, just posting it as law-giving, was unconstitutional. 1985, the court said that having a moment of silence in public school, without any vocalized prayer, that was unconstitutional. 1992, the court said you can't have prayer at a graduation ceremony. Then in 2000, you might remember this one, the Supreme Court ruled in a case coming out of Texas that it was unconstitutional to have a student-led prayer at a high school football game. Now, that case always seemed especially odd to me because in Texas, the exercise of football is an exercise of religion. So it seemed a bit of a contradiction in terms. But nevertheless, the court said even at a football game, you can't pray. Then in 2005, a couple years ago, in a really strange pair of cases, the Supreme Court said that it's unconstitutional to post the Ten Commandments in a Kentucky courthouse, but it's okay to have the Ten Commandments on a monument on the Texas State Capitol grounds. Now, you might think, wait a minute, what's the difference? Well, two words, Justice Breyer. It was a 5-4 decision in both cases. They were issued on the same day, and Justice Breyer just changed his mind on one or the other. He says, okay, Justice Breyer, what makes the difference? Why is it okay to have the Ten Commandments on a monument but not in the courthouse? He said, well, it's all about context. And on the monument, they're scrubbed of their religious significance. It seems more historical. It seems more secular. So it's okay to have the Ten Commandments if there's no religious connotation to them. Only when aren't scrubbed of their religious connotations is it okay to, is it unconstitutional to post the Ten Commandments. And all of this stuff, all of these ridiculous Supreme Court decisions come from the establishment of the First Amendment, which reads as follows, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. You might think, well, that's kind of strange. How do they get from establishment of religion to no Ten Commandments? How in the world do they get from point A to Z? Well, I'll tell you how they got. Well, let me first tell you what the words originally meant. The words originally meant no official national church. That's what establishment of religion was. Why did our framers put it right up front at the beginning of the First Amendment? They put it there because in England, in the second half of the 16th century, there had been the establishment of competing churches. Queen Mary had established the Catholic Church. Queen Elizabeth the First came along and disestablished the Catholic Church and established the Protestant Church that Henry VIII had started, reestablished that church. And in the intervening, in about the 50-year period there, there were countless rebellions and massacres all over the subject of whether England would be a Protestant or a Catholic nation. And so the Founding Fathers said, hey, we aren't going to have a national church. We don't want to fight about that. That's all the First Amendment was all about. just not having a national church. And by the way, several of the 13 states had state churches, official state churches, of Virginia, of Maryland, of Pennsylvania. That was quite all right. The framers said states can have their official churches, just not going to have a big fight over what the national church of the United States is. Somehow, the courts get from that to no moment of silence in public schools, to no posting of the Ten Commandments. It's ridiculous. But now, because of all these Supreme Court decisions, organizations like the ACLU can march into a small town, can wave these Supreme Court decisions in the air, and can say, look, it's not permissible for you to have that cross on your city seal, which was a challenge they recently brought in Redlands, California, and the city backed down. Or they can march into Republic, Missouri. Remember this about 8 years ago? That was a small town in Missouri that had the Christian fish symbol on its city seal. ACLU marches into town. Look at all these Supreme Court decisions. You have to take that off your city seal. And what's the little town going to do? They don't have the money to fight the ACLU in court, so they back down. And so now there's this constant march to drive any statement, any symbol, any words of God from our public square. Well, that's one battle in this cultural war. And unfortunately, we're losing, although there have been a few rays of hope, and maybe things will turn around. But another battle we've seen is one that I've talked about over the past few years. Maybe some of you have heard me talk about it, and that's the issue of gay marriage. I think that is a critically important battle in our culture, in our cultural war, and in generally the effort to undermine Christianity. The institution of marriage is under assault by those who try to refine marriage to mean whatever they want it to mean. Now, some leaders would say, hey, what are you worried about? That Goodridge decision of Massachusetts where they legalized gay marriage, that was in 2003. It's 5 years later. America hasn't crumbled. The institution of marriage hasn't ended in the United States. Why are you making all the fuss? Well, I answer, that's how Christian institutions are eroded in America. That's what people said in 1962 when the Supreme Court came down with the first decision. Why are you worried? It's just prayers. They can still read the Bible. They can still have a moment of silence. They can still pray at graduation, pray at the football games. What's all the fuss? We Christians are so often tempted to fall into the trap of incremental, or rather the deception of incrementalism. When things happen really slowly, we don't notice where it's going. And we say, oh, no big deal. But then 25 years later, it is a big deal. It's like the frog that boils in the water, that's in the pot of boiling water. The water temperature increases so slowly that the frog never realizes that it's boiling. And then suddenly it's too late, and it's all over. Well, similarly, we're surrounded by a pot of, you know, spiritual developments around us that are happening slowly. And, you know, if you look at one in isolation, it doesn't look like that big a deal. But things over time do become a big deal. Well, it was May 17th, 2004, that the state of Massachusetts started issuing gay marriage licenses. And on the first few days, people were coming in from all over the country to get them at a rate of more than 1,000 a day. Now, it's slowed down since then. But you have to remember, those folks are going back to their own states. And they're saying, okay, now the government of our state has to recognize this license that I got in Massachusetts. Now, the reason they can do that is the Full Faith and Credit Clause of Article 4, Section 1 of the U.S. Constitution. It says this, full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. End quote. Why'd the framers stick that in there? Because if you got a court decision in Virginia and you wanted to enforce it against the property owner who was now living in Maryland, the courts of Maryland had to respect the decision of the courts of Virginia. Now it's being used in a totally different context. The framers did not intend that gay marriage should then move from Massachusetts and spread to every other state because all the other states would have to recognize the validity of that official proceeding in Massachusetts. Now the solution to this problem is a pretty simple one. All it takes is a national constitutional amendment. Not that those are simple to do. We've only had 27 of them in the 232 years this country's been in existence. But that's what it would take. Now, the National Constitutional Amendment that would solve this problem was first proposed in 2003. We're nowhere near to getting that done. Well, things have continued. It wasn't just Massachusetts. You may have read that on May 15th of this year, 2008, California became the second state to make gay marriage official by a 4-3 decision. Again, both states were by a 4-3 decision of the state Supreme Court, ruled that the state constitution required the recognition of gay marriage on equal footing. And by the way, California already had a civil unions law that gave all of the legal benefits of marriage to gay couples. They just didn't have the word marriage attached to it. California Supreme Court said, you've got to give the word marriage too. It's got to be entitled to equal respect with the words the court used. Equal respect. So that has to happen. So the California Supreme Court rules. In addition to that, you've got four other states, New Hampshire, Vermont, New Jersey, and Connecticut, now permit civil unions. Now you're thinking, well, that's not going to affect us in Kansas, will it? It already has. You might have read in June in the Lawrence Journal World that Lawrence residents Mike Silverman and Dave Greenbaum got their marriage license at 8:15 a.m. June 17th in San Francisco. They were to be joined by hundreds of other couples, many of them from Kansas, who would do the same thing and then return to their home state and eventually demand that Kansas law, sooner or later it's going to happen, demand that Kansas law treat them the same way that they treat a traditional couple. And that's how Kansas will eventually be forced to extend these benefits to gay couples. Let me give you some examples of how this will play out. And it's basically legal chaos that comes up. And we're already in this period of legal chaos. Suppose that Mike and Dave split up, but they don't bother to go back to California to get a divorce. And then let's suppose that Mike decides at some point that he's no longer gay and that he'd like to marry a woman, and he gets married to a woman in Kansas. Well, has he committed bigamy? Is he married to two people? One court would say yes, another court would say no. Or maybe Mike gets a job in Lawrence with the fire department, and the fire department provides benefits for a spouse. And he says, well, I want my spouse to get those benefits. Does the city of Lawrence have to give them to him? I bet you they do. In fact, it's already happened in Overland Park. A gay couple in Overland Park demanded the same thing from the fire department and got benefits. Sooner or later, the courts in our state are going to have to grapple with these cases. And it's not just in the courts. The chaos is spreading all over. Let me give you a few more examples of this. And again, these are examples you're not reading about in your, you know, the Kansas City paper. They're not in the front, the nightly news. But it's all happening around us. Another case before the California Supreme Court this year was argued in May. Christian doctors at a San Diego fertility clinic declined to provide in vitro fertilization to a woman who was in a lesbian relationship. They believed that it wouldn't be appropriate for the child to be brought up in that relationship. Unfortunately, she sued. And the same California Supreme Court that legalized gay marriage is now about to render its ruling in that case. And something tells me the doctors aren't going to win and that the couple will win. In 2006, Catholic Charities, which had been providing extraordinary and far-ranging abortion services in the Boston area, decided that it had, sorry, not abortion, adoption services in, well, that's not likely, adoption services, yeah, that's another battle, and providing adoption services in the Boston area, Catholic Charities decided they had to stop providing all adoption services. Why? Because under state law in Massachusetts, if they provided adoption services to traditional couples, then they'd also have to provide adoption services on the same basis to gay couples. And that would go against church teaching, and so they can't provide adoption services to anyone now. How about another case? New Mexico, 2006. Husband and wife, who are evangelical Christians, have a photography shop in, I believe, Albuquerque. A woman comes into the shop and says, we want you to photograph our commitment ceremony. I'm getting united with my, in a civil ceremony, or a non-state ceremony, getting united with my partner. The evangelical Christians who run the shop say, no, sorry, we don't want to participate in that. The woman sues by bringing a complaint to the New Mexico Human Rights Commission and wins. The commission ordered the evangelical couple to pay the woman $6,600 in legal fees. This is the kind of thing that continues to happen, and we see the consequences if nothing is done. The consequences are several. One is we've already seen, and that's adoption. Gay couples get the same treatment and equal access under their marriage licenses. They say, why possibly under our state laws can you deny us adoption? And then there are lots of kids who are then placed through adoption into these households. Now, think of the children. Adoption is a wonderful blessing, and it's an incredible thing. My sister is adopted. But, at some point, adopted kids have a little bit of a hurdle to overcome, and they've got to, grapple with the idea of adoption and all of that. Imagine putting on top of that, explaining to your friends at school what the deal is with your parents and all the additional psychological hurdles. Plus, you have all of the hundreds of studies that show that kids that don't have a father and a mother in the home lose out. They lose out in education. They lose out in terms of emotional development. They lose out in terms of whether or not they're likely to graduate from school, more likely to commit crimes, you name it. All of these things depend on a mother and father being there in the home. What are the other consequences of losing this battle? Cultural normalization. textbooks. More than anything else, many of the activists on this issue just want a recognition, an official recognition, that gay relationships are the same and entitled to equal respect in every way that traditional marital relationships are. That's what they want. And they certainly don't want anyone quoting Romans 1:27 in public. That's what they're looking for, an affirmation from the state that their relationship is absolutely okay. And that's something, of course, through the textbook, then gets to our next generation of children. 25, 30 years from now, everybody, if they get their way, then everybody will say, hey, what's the big deal? Yeah, all that stuff in the Bible about marriage between a man and a woman, a man leaving his, cleaving to his, all that stuff, it's just strange, anachronistic, irrelevant stuff that doesn't have anything to do with American life today. And then thirdly, the third consequence is the institution of marriage itself. Now, you might be thinking, well, what are you afraid of? I mean, they do make the argument that it's not going to threaten your marriage if the state recognizes gay marriage, and indeed it won't threaten my marriage. But it affects the institution of marriage in a much bigger way. Look at what's happened in Scandinavia. All of the Scandinavian countries have recognized gay marriage officially. And at the same time, out-of-wedlock births have skyrocketed in those countries. In Norway, it's over 50%, Sweden over 55%, Denmark 60%, Iceland 65%. And it all coincides with the period when gay marriage is recognized. You might say, well, why does that work that way? It works that way because when the government says, when the state officially declares that it doesn't matter, that marriage mean anything, that marriage can go to any sort of relationship, then marriage comes to mean nothing. And the people say, hey, why bother getting married? Married doesn't really have a fixed meaning in our society anymore. So think about how much our culture has degraded and eroded over the past 50 years. Now, I wasn't alive in 1958, so I can't give you a firsthand account, but I did watch Leave It to Beaver a lot as a kid, and so I think I have a pretty good idea of what life was like in 1958, with Warden June Cleaver being my models. And something tells me that life in 1958 was a lot different than life in 2008 when it came to our national beliefs about our culture, about Christianity, and about right and wrong. And every time something happened between 1958 and 2008, when we saw something erode, when we saw some Christian belief assaulted by our culture, there weren't enough Christians who stood up and said, hey, wait a minute. No more. There's something wrong here. There weren't enough people standing up and saying, hey, wait a minute. And so we had a number of things happen in those 50 years. We had the sexual revolution happen. We had the abortion issue happen in Roe versus Wade in 1973. We had the rise of the drug culture. We had the emergence of a culture of violence on TV and in the movies. These are all individual cultural battles that have profound implications for Christians in America. And now we're again at a turning point with several battles. And I've mentioned two of them already, the effort to drive God from the public square, the effort to normalize homosexuality through gay marriage. And Pastor Russ was just talking about another one a few weeks ago with this false spirituality that cultural icons like Oprah are preaching to the masses with incredible power because they can reach so many people. We are under assault in so many different directions. And remember, if we don't stand up, if we don't recognize it, if we just focus on the little things and don't see the big picture, then 50 years from now, where will we be? This is going to look like the good old days in the year 2058. Now, I want to remember this deception of incremental change. I want to read you a quote, and I'm wrapping up here if you're getting tired. I want to read you a quote from Francis Schaeffer, who's a famous Christian thinker and writer. He wrote this in 1981, 27 years ago. He said this about Christianity in America. He said, the basic problem of Christians in this country in regard to society, in regard to government, is that they have seen things in bits and pieces instead of totals. They have very gradually become disturbed over permissiveness, pornography, the public school, the breakdown of the family, and finally abortion. But they have not seen this as a totality, each thing being a symptom of a much larger problem. They have failed to see that all of this has come about due to a shift in worldview. That is, through a fundamental change in the overall way people think and view the world and life as a whole. Shift has been away from a worldview that was at least vaguely Christian in people's memory towards something that is completely different. So what do we do? Well, I say, look at the Bible. And there are two cues that I see in the Bible, loud and clear. First, put on the armor of God. And second, pray. Now, when I say the armor of God, you know what I'm talking about. Ephesians 6:11, right? Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of the dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Therefore, put on the full armor of God, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground. And after you have done everything to stand, stand firm then, with the belt of truth buckled around your waist, the breastplate of righteousness in place, your feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. In addition to this, take up the shield of faith, with which you can exchange the flaming arrows of the evil one. Take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. And pray in the Spirit on all occasions with all kinds of prayers and requests. So you say, okay, I've heard that verse before. I'm thinking about it. I've got the armor on. Now what do? Get on the battlefield. That's why you're wearing the armor. The battlefield. In this context, the battlefield's all around us. The battlefield is in our schools. The battlefield is at the dinner table when you're talking with the kids. The battlefield is in the conversation over the backyard fence with the neighbor. It's in the conversation with your cousin. You know, that cousin that you don't speak to too often and you never would talk about religion because that would be so uncomfortable. It's in the voting booth. It's in writing a letter to the editor. It's in calling a talk show, sending an email to your congressman, or to your state representative, or just talking to people. And you know, it's so hard to do because our culture constantly tells you, don't talk about that. Don't talk about something controversial. Oh, don't bring up religion. Your culture says, no, that's not cool. That's not polite. But we have got to do it. Because if we're outfitted with the armor of God, we can do it. We can talk and we can persuade people. And if we do that, we can remain one nation under God. The second thing is to pray. Now, 2 Chronicles 7:14 explained really clearly. This is when the Lord came to King Solomon and spoke to him after the completion of the temple. And he said this, "If my people, who are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land." And so in closing, I ask you to join me in prayer. Almighty and wonderful Lord, you have blessed our nation so many times over. We thank you for our beloved founding fathers, for using them to establish this wonderful Christian nation. And we thank you for preserving our nation time and again whenever Americans have turned to you in prayer. We know that the prosperity and success of America has not